Didn't feel like leaving, so I studied the menu carefully and ordered a lamb cutlet. They take a nice long time to cook, and only cost 7 pence each. While I waited, I tried to ease my misery about Rose by thinking of my misery about Simon. But I found myself thinking of both miseries together. It's hopeless, I thought. All three of us are going to be unhappy for the rest of our lives. Then the lamb cutlet arrived, surrounded by a sea of white plate and looking smaller than I had believed any cutlet could. I ate it as slowly as possible. I even ate the sprig of parsley they throw in for the 7 pence. Then the waitress put the bill down on the table and cleared away my plate in a very final way. So, after a long drink of free water, I felt I had better go. I opened my bag to get out a tip for the waitress, and then... all my life, I shall remember it. My purse wasn't in my bag. I hunted frantically, but without any hope, because I knew that purse was still in the evening bag Rose had lent me. All I found through my search was a gritty farthing in the comb pocket. I felt icy cold and sick. The lights seemed to be much more glaring. The people all around seemed suddenly noisier and yet quite unreal. A voice in my head said, "Keep calm. Keep calm now. You can explain to the manager. Give him your name and address and offer to leave something of value." But I didn't have anything of value. No watch or jewellery. My bag was almost worn out. I hadn't even a coat or hat. For a wild minute I wondered if I could leave my shoes. "But he'll see you're a respectable person. He'll trust you," I tried to reassure myself. And then I began to wonder if I looked a respectable person. My hair was untidy. My green dress was bright and cheap compared with London clothes. And Heloise needing its belt didn't improve matters. "But they can't send for the police just for a pot of tea and one cutlet," I told myself. And then it dawned on me that it wasn't only for my bill that I needed money. How was I to get to the station without a taxi? I couldn't walk Heloise all those miles, even if I could manage them myself. And my railway ticket? That was in the purse too. "I've got to get help," I thought desperately. "But how?" There were call boxes in the front part of the restaurant, but apart from feeling I would rather die than telephone the flat, I knew it would involve Rose in impossible explanations. Then I suddenly remembered Stephen's message that he was always at my service. But could I bring myself to wake the Fox Cottons up at nearly 2 in the morning? I was still arguing with myself when the waitress came back and looked at me very pointedly, so I felt I had to do something. I got up, leaving my bill lying on the table. "I'm waiting for someone who's late. I'll have to telephone," I said. "Will you please keep this place for me?" Heloise hated being wakened, but I didn't dare leave her under the table. Mercifully, she was too sleepy to do any barking. I explained at the pay desk that I was going to telephone. I noticed the girl watching to see that I did go into a call box. It was dreadfully hot inside, particularly with Heloise slumped against me like a fur-covered furnace. I opened the book to find the Fox Cotton's number. And then I remembered. You need pennies to telephone from a public call box. "You'll laugh at this one day," I told myself. "You'll laugh like anything." And then I leaned against the call box wall and began to cry. But I soon stopped when I remembered that my handkerchief was in Rose's evening bag. I stared at the box you put the pennies in and thought how willingly I would rob it if I knew how. "Oh, please, God, do something," I said in my heart. Then a person who didn't seem to be me put my hand up very quickly and pressed button B. When the pennies came out, my inner voice said, "I knew they would." And then, in memory, I heard the vicar talking of prayer, faith, and the slot machine. Can faith work backwards? Could the fact that I was going to pray have made someone forget to take their pennies back? And if it was really prayer that did it, couldn't button B have saved me from troubling Stephen by giving me a pound? Though, of course, it would have had to be in pennies, I thought. I prayed again, then pressed the button, wondering how I could cope with a shower of 240 pennies. But I needn't have worried. So I got on with telephoning the Fox Cottons. Leader answered, sooner than I had expected. She sounded furious. I told her I was dreadfully sorry to disturb her, but that I simply couldn't help it. Then I asked her to get Stephen. She said, "Certainly not. You can't talk to him now." "But I've got to," I told her. "And I know he won't mind if you wake him. He'd want you to, if he knew I was in difficulties." "You can stay in difficulties until tomorrow morning," she said. "I won't let you bother Stephen now. It's disgusting the way..." She broke off, and for an awful second I thought she had hung up the receiver. Then I heard voices, though I couldn't distinguish any words, until she suddenly yelled out, "Don't you dare do that!" Then she gave a shrill little squawk, and the next second Stephen was speaking to me. "What's happened? What's wrong?" he cried. I told him as quickly as I could, leaving out the quarrel with Rose, of course. I said I'd meant to go home by a late train, but there isn't any late train. "Yes, there is," I said quickly. "There's one you didn't know about. Oh, I'll explain it all later. All that matters now is that I'm stranded here, and if you don't come along quickly, I shall get arrested. I'll start at once." He sounded terribly upset. "Don't be frightened. Go back to your table and order something else. That will stop them suspecting you. And don't let any men talk to you, or any women either. Especially hospital nurses." "All right. But do be as quick as you can." Afterwards, I wished I hadn't said that about being arrested, because I knew he would believe it, as I never quite had done myself. But being stranded like that in a London restaurant can be very panic-striking, particularly in the middle of the night, and I did want to make sure he would come. I was wringing wet when I hung the receiver up. I had to roll Heloise off my feet and simply drag her back to my table. Her eyes were just two pink slits. She was practically sleepwalking. I told the waitress my friend would arrive very soon and ordered a chocolate ice cream soda. Then I sat back and just wallowed in relief. It was so great that I forgot how unhappy I was and began to take an interest in my surroundings. There were some people at a nearby table who were connected with a new play. One of them was the author, and they were waiting for the morning papers with the notices of it to come out. It was funny how nice and interesting almost everyone looked once my panic was over. Before, there had been just a sea of noisy faces. While I was having my ice cream soda, it was glorious. A hospital nurse came in and sat at the very next table. I almost choked through my straw because I knew what poor Stephen had been driving at. Miss Marcy had a story that fake nurses rush about drugging girls and shipping them to the Argentine to be what she calls, well, daughters of joy, dear. But as I picture the Argentine, it has plenty of its own joyful daughters. Stephen didn't arrive until after 3 o'clock. He said he'd had to walk nearly a mile before finding a taxi. He had an odd, strained look, which I put down to his having been so frightened about me. I made him have a long, cold lemonade. "Did you snatch the telephone from Leda?" I asked. "It sounded like that." "What luck for me that you overheard her talking. Is there a telephone on the upstairs landing or something?" "There's one in the studio. We were in there," he said.
"Do you mean she was still photographing you?"
He said no. It was the other studio. The one where the big photographs are. We were just sitting, talking.
What? Till 2 in the morning?
Then I saw that he was avoiding my eyes, and went on quickly. "Well, tell me about your interview with the film people." He told me, but hardly a word of it sank in. I was too busy picturing him in the studio with Leda. I was sure she had been making love to him. I imagined them sitting on the divan with only one dim light burning and the great naked Negro looking down. The thought was horrible, yet fascinating. I came back to Earth as Stephen was saying, "I'll take you home and pack up my clothes, though Leda says I shall have to buy some better ones. And I'll see Mr. Stebbins. He said he wouldn't stand in the way of my career." Career sounded a funny word for Stephen.
"What will Ivy say?" I asked.
"Oh, Ivy." He seemed to be remembering her from a long way back. "She is a good girl, is Ivy." Somebody brought the morning papers to the people who were waiting for them. All the notices seemed to be very bad. The poor little author kept saying again and again, "It isn't that I mind for myself, of course." And his friends were all very indignant with the critics and said notices didn't mean a thing. Never had and never would. "I suppose you'll be getting notices soon," I said to Stephen. "Well, not notices exactly, but my name's going to be in print. There's to be a piece about me under the photograph leaders getting into the papers, saying how I'm a young actor of great promise. After this one picture, where I keep coming on with goats, I'm to go on a contract and be taught to act. But not too much, they say, because they don't want to spoil me." There was actually a note of conceit in his voice. It was so unlike him that I stared in astonishment. And he must have guessed why I did, because he flushed and added, "Well, that's what they said. And you wanted me to do it. Oh, let's get out of this place." I was glad to go. My relief at being rescued had worn off, and there seemed to me a stale, weary, unnatural feeling about the restaurant. The thought that it never closed made me feel exhausted for it. Most of the people now seemed tired and worried. The poor little author was just leaving, looking utterly downcast. The hospital nurse looked pretty cheerful, though. She was having her second go of poached eggs. We sat on a bench in Leicester Square for a while, with Heloise lying across both our laps. Her elbows dug into me most painfully, and I didn't like the feel of the square at all. It isn't a bit like most London squares. So I said, "Let's go and have a look at the Thames, now that it's getting light." We asked a policeman the way. He said,
"You don't want to use it for jumping in, do you, miss?"
Which made me laugh. It was quite a walk, and Heloise loathed it, but she perked up after we bought her a sausage roll from a coffee stall. We got to Westminster Bridge just as the sky was red with dawn. I thought of Wordsworth's sonnet, but it didn't fit. The city certainly wasn't all bright and glittering in the smokeless air. There was a lurid haze over everything, and I couldn't get the feeling of, "Dear God, the very houses seem asleep," because half my mind was still in the corner house, which never gets asleep at all. We stood leaning against the bridge, looking along the river. It was beautiful, even though I didn't get any feeling of peace. A gentle little breeze blew against my face. It was like someone pitying me. Tears rolled out of my eyes. Stephen said, "What is it, Cassandra? Is it something to do with me?" For a second I thought he was harking back to his having kissed me in the larch wood. Then I saw the ashamed expression in his eyes. I said, "No, of course not." "I might have known that," he said bitterly. "I might have guessed that nothing I've done tonight could matter to you. Who are you in love with, Cassandra? Is it Neil?" I ought to have told him he was talking nonsense, that I wasn't in love with anyone. But I was too tired and wretched to pretend. I just said, "No, it isn't Neil." "Then it's Simon." "That's bad, that is. Because Rose will never let him go."
"But she doesn't love him, Stephen. She admitted it."
I found myself telling him about our dreadful quarrel in her bedroom, describing how I had crept out of the flat. "You and your late trains," he put in. "I knew right well there wasn't one." I went on pouring it all out. When I told him I had realized how wrongly I had behaved to Rose, he said, "Don't you worry about that. Rose is bad." "Not really bad," I said, and began to make excuses for her, telling him she had wanted to help the family as well as herself. He cut me short by saying, "But she's bad, really. Lots of women are." I said, "Sometimes we're bad without meaning to be." And then I asked him if he could ever forgive me for letting him kiss me when I knew I was in love with someone else. "Oh, Stephen, that was bad. And I let you go on thinking I might get to love you." "I only did for a day or two. I soon saw I was making a fool of myself. But I couldn't make it out. Why you ever let me, I mean. I understand now.
Things like that happen when you're in love with the wrong person. Worse things. Things you never forgive yourself for. He was staring straight ahead of him, looking utterly wretched. I said, "Are you miserable because you made love to Leda Fox Cotton?" It was her fault, wasn't it? You don't need to blame yourself. "I'll blame myself as long as I live," he said, then suddenly turned to me. "It's you I love and always will. Oh, Cassandra, are you sure you couldn't ever get to care for me? You liked it when I kissed you. Well, you seemed to. If we could get married..." The glow from the sunrise was on his face. The breeze was blowing his thick, fair hair. He looked desperate and magnificent, more wonderful even than in any of Leda's photographs of him. The vague expression was gone from his eyes. I had a feeling it had gone forever. "I'd work for you, Cassandra. If I'm any good at acting, perhaps we could live in London, a long way from the others. Couldn't I help you through, somehow, when Simon's married to Rose?" When he said Simon's name, I saw Simon's face. I saw it as it had looked in the corridor off the ballroom, tired and rather pale. I saw the black hair growing in a peak on his forehead, the eyebrows going up at the corners, the little lines at the sides of his mouth. When first he shaved his beard, I thought he was quite handsome, but that was only because he looked so much younger and so much less odd. I know now that he isn't handsome. Compared with Stephen's, his looks aren't anything at all. And yet, as my eyes turned to Stephen, facing the sunrise, from Simon in the darkness of my mind, it was as if Simon's had been the living face and Stephen's the one I was imagining. Or a photograph, a painting, something beautiful but not really alive for me. My whole heart was so full of Simon that even my pity for Stephen wasn't quite real. It was only something I felt I ought to feel, more from my head than my heart, and I knew I ought to pity him all the more because I could pity him so little. I cried out, "Oh, please, please stop. I'm so fond of you, and so deeply grateful, but I could never marry you. Oh, Stephen, dear, I'm so very sorry." "That's all right," he said, staring in front of him again. "Well, at least we're companions in misfortune," I said. Then Heloise stood up and put her front paws on the parapet between us, and my tears dropped down and made grey spots on her gleaming white head. Chapter 15. I am writing this at Father's desk in the gatehouse. If it were the King's desk in Buckingham Palace, I could not be more surprised. It is now 9:30 in the evening. This time last week I was talking to Simon in that corridor off the ballroom. It feels like years and years ago. I mean to work at this journal until I wake Thomas at 2 o'clock. Last night he kept this watch and I took the second one. And very dreadful I felt during most of it. I'm less upset tonight, but still get nervous sinkings in my stomach every now and then. Oh, have we accomplished a miracle? Or done something so terrible that I daren't face thinking about it? I never finished my last entry. The memory of my tears falling on Heloise so flooded me with self-pity that I couldn't go on. But there wasn't much more to say about the trip to London. We came back on the first train. I slept most of the way, and slept again when we got home. It was the middle of the afternoon when I woke up to find myself alone in the castle. Stephen had gone over to Four Stones, Father was at Scotney, and Thomas was spending the weekend with his friend Harry. Stephen came home around 9 o'clock and went to bed without disturbing me. I was up in the attic writing this journal. As I heard him crossing the courtyard, I wondered if I ought to go down and talk to him, but I felt there was nothing helpful I could say. Later on, I thought I would at least make him some cocoa and chat about his film job. But by the time I got to the kitchen, the light in his room was out. He went back to London early on Monday morning, with his clothes in a little iron-bound sea-chest that old Mrs. Stebbins lent him. It had belonged to her brother, who ran away to be a cabin boy. I didn't go to the station because Stephen told me Mr. Stebbins was driving him there,
and I guessed Ivy would go too. I felt Stephen ought to have every chance to find consolation, and I would rather he found it with Ivy than with Leda, because Ivy is a really nice girl. I went out to talk to her and Mr. Stebbins when they drove up, as Stephen wasn't quite ready. Ivy had on a pale grey suit, tight white gloves, and the brightest blue hat I ever saw, which accentuated the red in her cheeks. She is a good-looking girl. Enormous feet, though. Stephen was so long coming that I went to find out what he was doing. I saw him through the open door of his bedroom, just staring around him. The window is so overgrown now that he seemed to be in a green cavern. "Perhaps you'll be famous when you see this room again," I said. "Though don't wait too long before you come and stay with us, will you?" "I won't be coming back," he said quietly. "Even if I'm no good as an actor, no, I won't come back." I said of course he would, but he shook his head. Then he gave one last look round the room. The photographs of me and his mother were gone. The bed was stripped and the one blanket neatly folded. "I've swept the room out so that you won't have anything extra to do," he said. "You can shut this place up and forget it. I gave Mr. Mortmain his books back before he went off to Scotney. I'll miss having books." "But you can buy them for yourself now," I told him. He said he hadn't thought of that. "I don't seem able to take in the money part somehow." "Mind you save, just in case," I warned him. He nodded and said he'd probably soon be feeding pigs again. Then we heard Mr. Stebbins hooting his horn. I said, "I'll see you off, but let's say a private goodbye here." I held up my hand, but added, "Please kiss me if you'd like to. I'd like it if you would." For a second I thought he was going to. Then he shook his head and barely clasped my hand. I tried to help him carry the little sea chest, but he hoisted it up on his shoulder. We went out to the car. Heloise was there, investigating the wheels, and after Stephen had strapped the chest onto the luggage carrier, he stooped and kissed her on the head. He never looked back once as they drove along the lane. While I was washing up the breakfast things, I realised that I had no idea where he would be staying. Would he go back to the Fox Cottons? I suppose Rose will know. I wrote to her that morning saying I had been in the wrong and asking her to forgive me. I must say she took her time about answering, but this afternoon I had a telegram from her which said she would write when she could and would I please try to understand. She didn't put in anything about forgiving me, but as it was signed, "Your ever-loving Rose," I suppose she has. I worked on my journal most of Monday, finishing in floods of tears too late to get my face right before Thomas came home. He said, "You've been howling, haven't you? I suppose the castle's depressing after being in London," which made things nice and easy for me. I said yes, that was it, and that it had been sad seeing Stephen go, and wondering what would happen to him. "I wouldn't worry about Stephen," said Thomas. "He's sure to be a riot on the pictures. All the girls in the village are in love with him. They used to hang about on the God's End Road trying to waylay him. One of these days you're going to find out what you've missed." I started to get tea. Thomas had brought a haddock. "Father'll get tea at Scotney, so we needn't wait," I said. "The servants must be tired of feeding him," said Thomas. "What does he do there day after day? Does he just read for the fun of it? Or is he up to something?" "Ah, if we only knew that," I said. "Harry says he ought to be psychoanalyzed." I turned in astonishment. "Does Harry know about psychoanalysis?"
"His father talks about it sometimes. He's a doctor, you know."
"Does he believe in it?"
"No, he's always very sneery. But Harry rather fancies it."
I had to concentrate on cooking the haddock then, but while we were eating it I brought up the subject of psychoanalysis again and told Thomas of the conversation Simon and I had had about it that first time we talked on the mound, though I couldn't remember it very clearly.
"I wish I'd got Simon to tell me more," I said.
"Would Harry's father have any helpful books, do you think?"
Thomas said he would find out. Though now that Rose was going to marry Simon, it didn't matter so much whether Father wrote or not.
"Oh, Thomas, it does," I cried. It matters most terribly to Father, and to us, too. Because if all the eccentric things he's been doing on and off for months now aren't leading somewhere, well, then he is going crazy. And a crazy father's not a good idea. Quite apart from our tender feelings towards him. Have you tender feelings towards him? I don't know that I have. Not that I dislike him. Just then Father came in. He barely said hello in answer to mine and started up the kitchen stairs to his bedroom. Halfway up, he stopped and looked down at us, then came back quickly. "Can you spare me this?" he asked, picking up the backbone of the haddock between his forefinger and thumb. I thought he was being sarcastic, that he meant we had left him no fish. I explained that we hadn't expected him and offered to cook some eggs at once. He said, "Oh, I've had tea," and then carried the haddock bone dripping milk out through the back door and across to the gatehouse. Ab followed him hopefully. By the time he got back, a very disappointed cat, Thomas and I were lurching about, laughing in a way that hurts. "Oh, poor Ab," I gasped, as I gave him some scraps from my plate. "Stop laughing, Thomas. We shall be ashamed of our callousness if Father really is going off his head." "He isn't. He's putting it on or something," said Thomas. Then a scared look came into his eyes and he added, "Try to keep knives away from him. I'm going to talk to Harry's father tomorrow." But Harry's father wasn't in the least helpful. "He says he's not a psychoanalyst or a psychiatrist or a psycho-anything, thank God," Thomas told me when he got back in the evening. "And he couldn't think why we wanted to make Father write again, because he once had a look at Jacob wrestling and didn't understand a word of it." Harry was quite embarrassed. "Does Harry understand it, then?" "Yes, of course he does. It's the first I've heard about it's being hard to understand. Anyway, what's Double Dutch to one generation's just the cat sat on the mat to the next?"
"Even the ladder chapter?"
"Oh, that." Thomas smiled tolerantly. "That's just Father's fun. And who says you always have to understand things? You can like them sometimes without understanding them. Like them better sometimes. I ought to have known Harry's father would be no help to us. He's the kind of man who says he enjoys a good yarn." I certainly have been underestimating Thomas. Only a few weeks ago, I should have expected him to enjoy a good yarn himself. And now I find he has read quite a lot of difficult modern poetry. Some master at his school lent it to him. I'm taking it in his stride. I wish he had let me read it, though I know very well I can't like things without understanding them. I am astonished to discover how highbrow his tastes are. Far more so than mine. And it is most peculiar how he can be so appreciative of all forms of art, but so matter-of-fact and unemotional about it. But then, he is like that over most things. He has been so calm and assured this last week that I often felt he was older than I was. Yet he can get the giggles and plunge back into being the most ordinary schoolboy. Really, the puzzlingness of people. After we talked about Harry's father, Thomas settled down to do his homework and I wandered out into the lane. There was a vast red sunset full of strangely shaped prophetic-looking clouds, and a hot due-south wind was blowing. An exciting sort of wind, I always think. We don't often get it. But I was too depressed to take much interest in the evening. All day long I'd been hopeful about psychoanalysis. I had expected Thomas to bring home some books we could get our teeth into. And I hadn't only been thinking of Father's welfare. Early that morning it had struck me that if he started writing again, Rose might believe there would be enough money coming in to make life bearable, and still might break her engagement off. I wasn't banking on winning Simon, even if she gave him up. But I knew, and shall always know, that he ought not to marry a girl who feels towards him as Rose does. I went to the end of the lane and turned onto the God's End Road, trying all the time to think of some way of helping both Father and myself. When I came to the high part of the road, I looked back and saw his lamp alight in the gatehouse. I thought how often I had seen it shining across the fields on my summer evening walks, and how it always conjured up an image of him, remote, withdrawn, unapproachable. I said to myself, surely one ought to know a little more of one's father than we do. And as I began walking back to the castle, I wondered if the fault could be ours as well as his. Had I, myself, really tried to make friends with him? I was sure I had in the past. But had I lately?
No.
I excused myself by thinking, oh, it's hopeless to make friends with people who never talk about themselves. And then it came to me that one of the few things I do know about psychoanalysis is that people have to be made to talk about themselves. Had I tried hard enough with Father? Hadn't I always been rebuffed too easily? Are you frightened of him? I asked myself. I knew in my heart that I was, but why? Has he ever in his life struck any of you? Never. His only weapon has been silence, and sometimes a little sarcasm. Then what is this insurmountable barrier around him? What's it made of? Where did it come from? It had become as if someone outside myself were asking the questions, attacking me with them. I tried to find answers. I wondered if Mother's training that we must never worry or disturb him had gone on operating, and Topaz had perpetuated it by her habit of protecting him. I wondered if I had some undetected fear left from the day when I saw him brandishing the cake knife. If I believed, without ever having admitted it, that he really did mean to stab Mother. Heavens, I thought. I'm psychoanalyzing myself now. If only I could do this to Father. I had come round the last bend of the lane and could see him through the lamp-lit window of the gatehouse. What was he doing? The fact that he was at his desk didn't necessarily mean he was writing. He always sits there when reading the encyclopedia, because it is so heavy to hold. Was he reading now? His head was bent, but I couldn't see what over. Just then he raised his hand to push his hair back. He was holding a pencil. And that instant the voice that had been attacking me as I walked home said, "Suppose he's really working all the time. Supposing he's writing some wonderful money-earning book. But you don't find out until it's too late to help you and Rose." I began walking towards the castle again. I don't remember planning anything, even making a definite decision. It was as if my mind could not go ahead of my steps. I went into the dimness of the gatehouse passage, then into the blackness of the tower staircase. I groped my way up to Father's door. I knocked on it. "Go away," came the instant reply. The key was in the outside keyhole, so I knew he hadn't locked himself in. I opened the door. As I went in, he swung round from his desk looking furious. But almost before I had time to notice his expression, it was as if a curtain came down over it and the fury was hidden. "Something important?" he asked in a perfectly controlled voice. "Yes, very," I said, and shut the door behind me. He got up, looking at me closely. "What's the matter, Cassandra? You're unusually pale. Are you ill? You'd better sit down." But I didn't sit. I stood there staring at the room. Something had happened to it. Facing me, instead of the long rows of bookshelves stretching between the north and south windows, was an expanse of brightly coloured paper. "Heavens! What have you been doing in here?" I gasped. He saw what I was staring at. "Oh, those are just American comic strips, commonly called the funnies. And what is it, Cassandra?" I went closer and saw that what I had taken for wallpaper was sheets and sheets from newspapers, the top edges of which were tacked to the edges of the bookshelves. In the dim light from the lamp I couldn't see the pictures clearly, but they seemed to be small coloured illustrations joined together. "Where did they come from?" I asked. "I brought them back from Skokie yesterday. They're from the American Sunday papers. I gather Neil can't live without them." "Good heavens, don't start reading them."
"Are they to do with your work?"
He opened his mouth to reply, and then a nervous, secretive look came into his eyes. "What have you come here for?" he said sharply. "Never you mind about my work."
I said, "But it's that I've come about. Father, you've got to let me know what you're doing." For a second he stared at me in silence. Then he said icily,
"And is that the sole reason for this visitation? To cross-examine me?"
"No, no," I began, and then pulled myself up. "Yes, it is. It's exactly that, and I'm not giving up until I get an answer."
"Out you go," said Father. He took me by the arm and marched me to the door. I was so astonished that I put up hardly any resistance. But at the last second, I jerked away from him and dashed across to his desk. I had a wild hope that I might see some of his work there. He was after me instantly, but I just had time to catch a glimpse of pages and pages with long lists on them in his writing. Then he grabbed me by the wrist and pulled me round. Never have I seen such fury as was in his eyes. He flung me away from the desk with such force that I went right across the room and crashed into the door. It hurt so badly that I let out a yell and burst into tears. "Oh, God, is it your elbow?" said Father. "That can be agony." He came over and tried to feel if there were any broken bones. Even through the pain I noticed how astonishingly his anger had vanished. I went on choking with tears. It really was agony, right down to my wrist and hand. After a minute or so, Father began to walk me up and down with his arm round me. "It's going off," I told him as soon as I could. "Let me sit down for a bit." We sat on the sofa together, and he lent me his handkerchief to mop up on. Soon I was able to say, "It's almost better now. Look." I moved my hand and arm to show him. "It was nothing serious." "It might have been," he said in a queer, strained voice. "I haven't lost my temper like that since." He stopped dead, then got up and went back to his desk. I said, "Not since you went for Mother with the cake knife?" And was astounded to hear the words coming out of my mouth. I added hastily, "Of course, I know you didn't really go for her. It was all a mistake, but, well, you were very angry with her. Oh, Father, do you think that's what has been the matter with you? That you stopped getting violent? Has repressing your temper somehow repressed your talent?" He gave a sarcastic snort and didn't even bother to look round. "Who put that brilliant idea into your head? Was it Topaz?"
"No, I thought of it myself just this minute."
"Very ingenious of you, but it happens to be nonsense." "Well, it's no sillier than believing you dried up because you went to prison," I said, astonishing myself again.
"Some people do think that, you know."
"Idiots," said Father. "Good God, how could a few months in prison do me any harm? I've often thought I'd like to be back there. At least the warders never sat round holding post-mortems on me. Oh, for the peace of that little cell."
His tone was very sarcastic, but nothing like so angry as I had expected. So I plucked up my courage to go on. "Have you any idea yourself what stopped you working?" I kept my voice calm and conversational. "Simon thinks, of course." He swung round instantly, interrupting me.
"Simon, were you and he discussing me?"
"Well, we were being interested in you."
"And what theories did Simon put forward?"
I had meant to say that Simon had suggested psychoanalysis, but Father looked so angry that I funked it and racked my brains for something more tactful. At last I brought out, "Well, he once thought you might have been held back because you were such an original writer that you couldn't just develop like ordinary writers, that you'd have to find some quite new way." I was floundering, so I finished up quickly. "He said something like it that first evening they ever came here, don't you remember?"
"Yes, perfectly," said Father, relaxing. "I was very much impressed. I've since come to the conclusion that it was merely a bit of supremely tactful nonsense on Simon's part, God bless him. But at the time it certainly fooled me. I'm not at all sure that wasn't what started me on..." He broke off. "Well, well, run along to bed, my child."
I cried out,
"Oh, Father, do you mean you have found a new way to work? Do all these crazy things, the crosswords and little folks and the homing pigeon and what not, do they really mean something?"
"Great heavens, what do you take me for? Of course they mean something.
Even the willow pattern plate, and trying to read gramophone records. How exciting!"
"Oh, I simply can't imagine..." "You don't have to," said Father firmly. "You just have to mind your own business."
"But couldn't I help you? I'm reasonably intelligent, you know. Don't you ever feel you want to talk to anyone?"
"I do not," said Father. "Talk
Talk. You're as bad as Topaz.
As if either of you would have the remotest idea what I was driving at. And if I'd talked to her, she'd have told every painter in London. And you'd tell Simon, and he'd write a well-turned article about it. Good Lord. How long does an innovation remain one if it's talked about? And anyway, with me secrecy's the very essence of creation. Now go away.
I said, I will if you'll answer me just one question. How long will it be before the book's finished?
Finished? It isn't even begun. I'm still collecting material. Though that'll go on indefinitely, of course.
He began to walk about, talking more to himself than to me.
I believe I could make a start now if I could get a scaffolding that really satisfied me. I need a backbone.
Was that why you took the haddocks? I said involuntarily. He turned on me at once.
Don't be facetious.
Then I think he saw from my face that I hadn't meant to be, because he gave a snort of laughter and went on.
No.
The haddock may be said to have turned into a red herring across the trail. Lots of things do.
I don't know, though. The ladder-like pattern was interesting. I must study the fishes of the world. And whales. And the forerunners of whales.
He was talking to himself again, moving about the room. I kept dead quiet. He went on.
Primeval. Antediluvian. The Ark? No, not the Bible again. Prehistoric. From the smallest bone of the mammoth. Is there a way there?
He hurried to his desk and made a note, then sat there, still talking to himself. I could only make out broken phrases and disjointed words, things like design, deduction, reconstruction, symbol, pattern, and problem.
Search forever unfolding. Enigma eternal.
His voice got quieter and quieter, until at last he was silent. I sat there staring at the back of his head, framed in the heavy stone mullions of the window beyond it. The lamp on his desk made the twilight seem a deep, deep blue. The tick of the little travelling clock that used to be Mother's sounded unbelievably loud in the quietness. I wondered if the idea he was searching for was coming to him. I prayed it might, for his own happiness. By then I had no hope it could be in time to help Rose and me. After a few minutes I began to think I had better creep out, but I was afraid that opening the door would make a noise. And if his idea has come, I thought, disturbing him now might wreck everything. Then it struck me that if he once got used to having me in the room, I might be a real help. It came back to me that he had liked Mother to sit with him while he wrote, provided she kept quite still. He wouldn't even let her sew. I remembered her telling me how hard she had found it in the beginning, how she had told herself she would manage just 5 more minutes, then another 5, until the minutes grew into hours. I said to myself, in 10 minutes her little clock will chime 9. I'll sit still until then. But after a couple of minutes, bits of me began to tickle maddeningly. I stared at the lamplit face of the clock, almost praying to it to hurry. Its ticking seemed to get louder and louder until it was right inside my ears. I had just got to a stage when I felt I couldn't bear it a second longer when the wind burst one of the south windows open. The American newspapers tacked to the bookshelves blew up with a great flap, and Father swung round. His eyes seemed to have sunk deeper into his head. He blinked. I could see he was coming back from very far away. I expected him to be angry at my still being there, but he just said, "Hello," with a sort of dazed pleasantness. "Was the idea any good?" I ventured. For a second, he didn't seem to know what I was talking about, then he said,
"No, no, another marsh light. Were you holding your fingers crossed for me, poor mouse-like child? Your mother used to sit like that."
"I know. I was thinking of her a minute ago."
"Were you?"
"So was I. Probably telepathy. The newspapers flapped again, and he went to close the window, then stood looking down into the courtyard. I thought he was going to forget me again, so I said quickly, "Mother helped you quite a lot, didn't she?"
"Yes, in an odd, oblique way."
He sat down on the window seat, apparently quite prepared for a little chat.
"God knows she never had an idea in her head, dear woman.
But she had the most extraordinary habit of saying useful things by accident.
Like mentioning the name Jacob, when I was searching for a central idea for Jacob Wrestling.
Actually, she was talking about the milkman.
And having her in the room seemed to give me confidence. The atmosphere used to become quite thick with her prayers.
Well, good night, my child.
He got up and came towards me. Is the elbow better?
I said, quite, thank you.
Good. Next time you come, I'll try to give you a better welcome. Put the red carpet down. But you must wait until you're invited. I must say I'm curious to know what keyed you up to this attack tonight. Mrs. Cotton wasn't doing a little prodding by proxy, was she?
Gracious, no. Of course, I had no intention of telling him my real reason for coming. It would have worried him quite uselessly, besides being unfair to Rose. It was only that I was anxious.
Good Lord. Do you mean about my state of mind?
He chuckled, then looked concerned.
You poor girl. Did you really think my brain was going? Well, I dare say I seemed pretty eccentric, and plenty of people will think that's an understatement when this book gets out, if it ever does. Why can't I take the plunge? It's just the initial idea that eludes me.
I've lost confidence, you know. It isn't laziness, I swear. There was a humble, almost pleading note in his voice.
It never has been. I hope you believe that, my dear.
It just hasn't been possible.
I said, of course I believe it.
And I believe you're going to start very soon now.
I hope so.
He laughed a little, in an odd, nervous kind of way.
Because if I don't get going soon, the whole impetus may die. And if that happens, well, I really shall consider a long, restful plunge into insanity. Sometimes the abyss yawns very attractively.
There, there, don't take me seriously.
Of course not, I said briskly.
Now, look, Father. Why not let me sit here as Mother used to? I'll pray as she did. I'm really quite good at it.
And you go to your desk and start this very night.
No, no. I couldn't yet. He looked positively frightened.
I know you mean well, my dear, but you're making me nervous. Now run along to bed.
I'm going myself. He lifted up the American papers and dived under to the shelf holding his old detective novels, grabbing one quite at random. Then he put the lamp out. Just as we went out of the room, Mother's little clock began to strike 9. Even after Father had locked the door and we were groping our way down the pitch-black stairs, I could hear the tiny tinkling chimes.
"I must remember to carry matches," he said. "Now there's no Stephen to leave a lamp outside my door."
I said I would see to it in future. There was no lantern in the gatehouse passage either. Another of Stephen's jobs. All the time, I find out more and more things he did without my ever realizing it. "Let me make you some cocoa, Father," I suggested as we went into the kitchen. But he said he didn't need anything.
"Except a biscuit, perhaps. And find me a candle with at least 3 hours reading in it."
I gave him a whole plate of biscuits and a new candle.
"The richness of our life these days never ceases to astonish me," he said as he went up to bed.
Thomas was deep in his homework at the kitchen table. I waited until I heard Father go through to Windsor Castle, then said quietly,
"Come on out. I've got to talk to you. Bring a lantern so that we can go into the lane. I don't want Father to hear our voices through some open window."
We went as far as the stile and sat on it with the lantern balanced between us. Then I told him everything, except my true reason for bearding Father. I said it was due to a sudden impulse. "Well, how does it sound to you?" I finished up.
"Perfectly awful," said Thomas.
I'm afraid he really is going crazy. I was taken aback. Then I've made him sound worse than he seemed through telling it too quickly. It was only at the very end that his manner was odd, and a bit, perhaps, when he was talking to himself about whales and mammoths. But all those changes of manner, being furious with you one minute, then really pleasant. And when you add up all the silly things he's been interested in lately, oh, Lord, when I think of him taking that haddock bone. He began to laugh. I said, "Don't, Thomas. It's like people in the 18th century laughing at the lunatics in Bedlam." "Well, I bet I'd have laughed at them myself. Things can be funny even when they're awful, you know. But I wonder..." He was suddenly serious. "Are we like Harry's father jeering at Jacob Wrestling? Perhaps he really has something up his sleeve. Though I don't like the sound of all those lists he's making. It's like taking too many notes at school. You feel you've achieved something when you haven't." "You mean he may never get going on the book itself?" I was quiet for a minute, staring into the lantern. Though what I saw all the time was Father's face when he was looking humble and nervous. "Oh, Thomas, if he doesn't, I think he will go out of his mind. You said he wasn't serious about plunging into insanity, but I believe I felt he was. He may be a borderline case. Madness and genius are very close to each other, aren't they? If only we could push him the right way." "Well, you haven't made much of a start tonight," said Thomas. "You've just driven him to bed with a detective novel. Anyway, I'm going in. Whether Father's sane or off his rocker, I've still got to do my algebra." "You can make him X, the unknown quantity," I said. "I think I shall stay here for a while. Can you manage without the lantern?" He said he could. There was quite a bit of starlight. "Though it won't do you any good to sit here brooding," he added. But I didn't plan to brood. I had decided to look up the record of my talk with Simon about psychoanalysis, on the off chance of finding something helpful. And I had no intention of letting Thomas know where my journal was hidden. I waited until I felt sure he would be back in the castle, then cut across the meadow and climbed the mound. A little cloud of white moths came all the way with me, hovering round the lantern. It felt strange going from the warm, blowy night into the cool stillness of Belmont Tower. As I climbed down the ladder inside, I thought of being there with Simon on Midsummer Eve, as I do every time I go into the tower. Then I pulled myself together. "This may be your last hope of keeping your father out of a padded cell," I told myself severely. And by then, a faint flicker of hope on my own account had reawakened. I felt that if I once got him even started on an important book, Rose just might be persuaded to postpone her marriage, and then anything might happen. I crawled up the crumbling staircase and brought down my bread tin. I have used that for some time now because ants kept getting into the attaché case. I spread my three journals out on the old iron bedstead and sat there looking through them. I could read quite well by the light from the lantern. It didn't take me long to find the entry for May Day, with a bit about psychoanalysis. First came the speech in which Simon said he didn't believe Father stopped writing just because he had been in prison, that the trouble probably lay much further back. But prison might have brought it to the surface. Anyway, a psychoanalyst would probably ask Father questions about the time he spent there. In a way, try to put him mentally back in prison. And then there was the bit about it being possible that another period of physical imprisonment might resolve the trouble. But Simon said that was unworkable as a treatment because it couldn't be done without Father's consent. And if he gave it, of course, he wouldn't feel imprisoned. There didn't seem to be anything I could do along those lines. I glanced through another page in case I had missed something, and came to the description of Simon's face as he lay on the grass with his eyes closed. It gave me a stab in which happiness and misery were somehow a part of each other. I closed the journal and sat staring up into the dark shaft of the tower. And then... suddenly the whole plan was complete in my mind almost to the last detail. But surely I meant it as a joke then. I remember thinking how it would make Thomas laugh. It was still a joke while I put my journals away and began to climb out of the tower. I had to mount the ladder very slowly because I needed one hand for the lantern. I was halfway up when the extraordinary thing happened. God's End church clock had begun to strike 10. And suddenly, as well as the far-off booming bell, I heard in memory the tinkling chime of Mother's little travelling clock. And then my mind's eye saw her face, not the photograph of it, which is what I always see when I think of her, but her face as it was. I saw her light brown hair and freckled skin. I had forgotten until then that she had freckles. And that same instant, I heard her voice in my head. After all these years of not being able to hear it, a quiet, clipped little voice it was, completely matter-of-fact, it said, "Do you know, dear, I believe that scheme of yours might work quite well." I heard my own voice answer, "But Mother, surely we couldn't. It's fantastic." "Well, your father's quite a fantastic man," said Mother's voice. That second, a gust of wind slammed the tower door just above me, startling me so that I nearly lost my footing on the ladder. I steadied myself, then listened again for Mother's voice, asked her questions. All I heard was the last stroke of the church clock, but my mind was made up. I hurried back to the castle and got Thomas to come out again. To my surprise, he didn't think my plan was as wild as I did myself. He was dead keen from the beginning, and most businesslike. "You give me the housekeeping money, and tomorrow I'll buy everything we need," he said. "And then we'll do it the very next day. We've got to act quickly, because Topaz may be home next week." I didn't mention my strange experience of being advised by Mother. I might have if he had put up any opposition to the scheme, but he never did. Do I really believe I was in touch with Mother? Or was it something deep in myself choosing that way to advise me? I don't know. I only know that it happened. Father went to scope me the next morning, so there was no danger of his seeing what I was up to. By the time Thomas came home, I had everything in readiness except for the few things that were too heavy for me to carry alone. He helped me with those, and then we made our final plans. "And we must do it the first thing after breakfast," said Thomas, "or he may go off to Scotney again." The minute I woke up on Thursday morning, I thought, I can't go through with it. It's dangerous. Something dreadful might happen. And then I remembered Father saying that if he didn't start work soon, the impetus might die. All the time I was dressing, I kept thinking, oh, if only I could be sure it's the right thing to do. I tried to get more advice from Mother. Nothing happened. I tried praying to God. Nothing happened. I prayed to anyone who is listening, please. To the morning sun, to nature, via the wheat field. At last, I decided to toss for it. And just then, Thomas came rushing in to say that Father wasn't waiting until after breakfast, would be off to Scotney at any minute. And instantly I knew that I did want to carry through our scheme, that I couldn't bear not to. The squeak of bicycle tyres being pumped up came in through the open window. "It's too late. We're sunk for today," said Thomas. "Not yet," I said. "Get out of the house without letting him see you. Go along the walls and down the gatehouse stairs, then dash up the mound and hide behind the tower. Be ready to help. Go on, quick." He bolted off, and I hurried down to the courtyard, pretending to be very worried that Father was leaving without his breakfast. "Oh, they'll give me some at Scotney," he said, airily. Then I talked about his bicycle, offering to clean it for him, telling him it needed new tyres. "Let me pump up that back one a bit harder for you," I said, and kept at it until I felt Thomas would have had enough time. Then, just as I was handing the bicycle over, I remarked casually, "Oh, can you spare a minute to come up to Belmont Tower? I think you may want to let someone at Scotney know what's been happening in there." "Oh, Lord, did that last heavy rain do a lot of damage?" said Father. "Well, I think you'll see quite a few changes," I said, with the utmost truthfulness. We crossed the bridge and started to climb the mound. "One doesn't often see an English sky as blue as this," he said. "I wonder if Simon's agent has authority to do repairs to the tower." He went on chatting most pleasantly and normally. All my misgivings were rushing back, but I felt the die was cast. Really, I ought to spend more time in here.